As chair of the Faculty of Law at Cambridge, it is my very great pleasure to welcome you all to Cambridge and to the university and to the faculty. International law has always been central to this faculty's work, arguably since the days of Sir Thomas Smith. It's possibly true that Sir Thomas Smith is not well known as a public international lawyer. He was, in fact, the first professor of civil law, that is to say, Roman law, in this university, appointed in the 1540s. He was also a Roman lawyer. However, as Secretary of State to Queen Elizabeth I, he devoted a great deal of his time to travelling around continental Europe, essentially resolving boundary disputes, drafting treaties, and so on. He was an exponent of jet-set diplomacy, although on horseback. This historic role for international law was confirmed by the creation of the Huell Chair in International Law in 1868, itself a pioneering development. Honesty compels me to say that Oxford beat us to it by a decade in having a chair in international law, but I wouldn't make a contest out of this. At the heart of our teaching and research in international law in the modern era is the Lauterpacht Centre for International Law, and at the heart of the centre for so many years was Sir Eli Lauterpacht. He was, of course, the prime mover in establishing the centre in 1983, and for many people and for many years, he was the living embodiment of international law at Cambridge. I should say also that he also embodied the values of this faculty in his scholarship, in his concern for teaching and nurturing future generations of lawyers, but also in his commitment to a very key aspect of our work on which we pride ourselves at Cambridge, that is to say, our public engagement. In his case, public engagement with policymakers and, of course, with the world of practice. It is fitting that the name of the Centre for International Law, dating from 1996, should honour the contribution made to this faculty and to research in international law, first by Sir Hersch Lauterpacht and then, of course, by Sir Eli himself. In our proceedings today and at tomorrow's memorial service, we will have the opportunity to reflect on this very special contribution to this faculty and to international law. For now, it is simply for me to say that international law will always be at the core of this faculty's work, just as Sir Eli Lauterpacht will always rank amongst our greatest scholars. I know that today's symposium will further the long tradition of international law debate at Cambridge, just as Eli Lauterpacht himself would have wished. You are all most welcome.
Welcome to the Lauterpacht Center for International Law Symposium, celebrating Sir Eli Lauterpacht's life and work. We have a rich program this afternoon. After the inaugural annual Eli Lauterpacht Lecture by Professor Dino Kritsiotis from the University of Nottingham, we will have two panels composed of Eli's colleagues and former students who will discuss Eli's work and Eli's vision for the Lauterpacht Center. Virtually everyone whom we invited to be a panelist agreed in an instance, some even cancelling trips and other commitments, all expressing their love and admiration for Eli. I have never seen such an immediate and enthusiastic response to a conference invitation. This tells volumes about Eli's warmth and devotion to his students and to his friends, who continue to appreciate his guidance and his friendship. Almost exactly 5 years ago, Eli presented his recollections and reflections of his career in international law at the opening Friday lunchtime lecture of 2012. By the way, his remains the most viewed recording of our series, with 24,533 views. In his recollection, Eli talks about the center. This is what he said. It was suggested to me in 1983 by the then UL professor Sir Robert Jennings and his successor Professor Bowett and Clive Perry that we should have a Center for International Law which I would create and administer. Well, as you probably all know, money is a useful driving force in the creation and maintenance of such an establishment, and we had no money. So the International Law Center was centered in my study, in my house, in Herschel Road, for some years, and it was all done in there. Ellie continued mentioning one person who is fortunately with us today, and who since has made a significant donation to the center. Initially, we used to promote research work, and one of the most significant products of our initiative has been a massive study on ICSID, prepared by Professor Scheuer of Vienna, who was one of our LLB students here, who has gone to significant prominence in the field. Ellie kept on developing the center, both in the intellectual sense and in the physical sense, thanks to the generous support of donors, many of whom are here with us today. These include Mrs. Julie Finley, whose major donation enabled Ellie to build an extension to the building that houses the Finley Library, and the state of Bahrain, represented today by Foreign Minister His Excellency Khalid bin Ahmed Al Khalifa, whose donation in 2002 helped Ellie to purchase our second building. The Lauterpacht family, including Sir Ellie himself, Lady Lauterpacht and their children, and Cambridge University Press. Other donors who are present here today are Dr. Ivan Berkovich, Judge Professor James Crawford, Dr. Joanna Gomula, Judge Sir Christopher Greenwood, and Sir Michael Wood. Ellie's vision continues vibrantly at the center. It is now the intellectual home of 30 permanent fellows, as well as over 50 visiting fellows per year who come from around the world. Since recently, we also offer working spaces to all Cambridge PhD students in international law. We host several research groups in various areas of international law. I am not aware of any other center that offers such a rich intellectual experience to scholars and practitioners of international law. In keeping with Ellie's vision, we launched today the Ellie Lauterpacht Fund in an effort to continue to develop the center and promote cutting-edge scholarship in international law. In addition to our ambition to be able to convene more and bigger seminars on a wide range of topics, welcoming leading scholars and practitioners from diverse backgrounds and regions, we are working to create an archive for the papers of international lawyers with strong connection to Cambridge. Thereby, we hope to attract more scholars from across the world who are interested in the history of international law. And we also seek to establish an Ellie Lauterpacht Visiting Fellowship to allow us to invite each year a scholar or a practitioner in international law whose work is relevant to our fellows, to spend at least a month at the center and join in research collaborations. Further details about the fund can be found on pages 14, 15 of the symposium program. And now I have the privilege and honor to give the floor to Dame Rosalind Higgins, former president of the International Court of Justice and an honorary fellow of the center. Please.
Thank you very much indeed, Eyal. As one who has felt for long years close to Ellie and to Kathy Lauterpacht, I'm honored and pleased to be speaking at this opening session of the seminar. The task, I think, has not been easy because both today and again tomorrow at the memorial service in Trinity, we will hear so much about Ellie's contribution to international law, including in contributions which will be given as memorial addresses by Judges Schwebel and Greenwood. And I certainly don't wish prematurely to tread the very same ground as I imagine they will wish to traverse. I've also been mindful of the rather full obituaries of Ellie, which appeared in the Telegraph, Times, Guardian and Independent, which Christopher Greenwood, Philippe Sands, Daniel Bethlehem and I prepared. So we must certainly be reminded of Ellie and the Centre, Ellie and the International Law Reports, Ellie and the many other law reports we owe to him, Ellie and the Australian years. What a life. Pondering this dilemma and reviewing Ellie's life in international law, I was struck for the first time by something I had never before particularly noticed and thought it merited attention here. Ellie's career was, of course, a glittering one, but I think we fail to notice how very unusual his career path was. In the United Kingdom, those international lawyers we regard as at the top of their profession will usually have written heavy books, been a favorite choice by government to advise and represent them in international litigation, been selected to serve on the International Law Commission by their government or on another senior UN body, have been a leading actor at the Institut du Droit International. This was not Ellie's career path. He was counsel in 11 cases at the International Court of Justice and many, many, many others in different fora. But in the 5 cases involving the United Kingdom during Ellie's working life, he was not the lead counsel for the United Kingdom. He did not serve on the International Law Commission. And for that and other reasons, we don't associate him with major and comprehensive projects of international law, such as the codification of the law of treaties, of state responsibility, the drafting of a statute for the International Criminal Court. And the reality is that Ellie would probably not much have enjoyed being a member of the ILC. Certainly, Sir Hersch Lauterpacht had not much appreciated the experience. We know from Ellie's magnificent Life of Hersch Lauterpacht that Hersch wrote to Rachel, his wife, saying, "I'm not sure whether I'll wish to remain with them. I'm much respected, and the people are very friendly, but the majority do not know any international law." Ellie, like his father, preferred to work alone, or with a small team of his choice. Hours and hours in set meeting formats, listening to the read-out views of others was not Ellie's thing. Indeed, if truth be told, Ellie was not so interested either in listening to lectures given by others. And I remember him advising me early that the best way to cope with the stream of books so kindly sent in by generous authors was to adopt his letter in reply, which said, "Thank you so much. I shall lose no time in reading your book." He was not a stalwart of the peripatetic lecture audience. He preferred to be immersed in the practical matters that were filling and illuminating his days. Ellie was, of course, one of the leading advocates of the last half century. He started very early, assisting his father behind the scenes in cases in which Sir Hersch was instructed. He was, alongside Sir Hirsch and Lord McNair, a member of chambers at 3 Essex Court, and for long years he kept a flat in Essex Court, where he met clients and welcomed friends. Thus, already in the early 1950s, Ellie was assisting, though not directly instructed, in the famous Notterbohm case. The views of Sir Hirsch were keenly sought, especially by the UK government, for his remarkable knowledge and ability. But his role was not that of front-line advocate. By contrast, Ellie rapidly became appreciated by governments, very specially for his skills as an advocate. He was in a stream of cases before the International Court. These included North Sea Continental Shelf, Barcelona Traction, nuclear tests, Pakistan v. India, El Salvador v. Honduras, Botswana v. Namibia, the Avena case, Qatar and Bahrain, India, Malaysia, and in 2013, Timor-Leste and Australia. Sometimes Ellie was brought into a case that was thought to be foundering. Such was his stature that he didn't need to confine himself to positions and arguments already taken. In Indonesia, Malaysia, for example, where his help was sought somewhat late in the day by Malaysia, he found an elegant way effectively to present the court with an entirely new set of arguments. I had the pleasure of hearing Ellie from the bench in some of these cases, which confirmed his standing as one of the counsel most appreciated by the court. His knowledge of the law was taken as a given. Of the English-speaking counsel who regularly appeared before the court, Ellie, Derek Bowett, and Arthur Watts were particularly enjoyed by the court. Derek Bowett's style was feisty. With Arthur Watts, the court knew it would systematically and quietly be taken from points A to B and then logically on to the end of the argument. With Ellie, it was different again. Behind his relaxed and cheerful style lay a sharpness of mind and an ability to use his great knowledge of the court's case law and of international law generally in a most creative way. Novel and persuasive arguments were built, and the bench was invited to immerse itself in this creative thinking. Ellie's celebrated style of advocacy, cheerful, engaging, with malice towards none, fits, I think, with the general pattern of his life in international law. The evidencing of enthusiasm for the subject and pleasure in tackling its problems. He was never negative, never disagreeable to his opponents, never contemptuous of others or their arguments. This was a man of enormous skills who simply loved his subject. Now, different views about the desirability of the concept of an ad hoc judge at the International Court may legitimately be held. And we have among us those who have occasionally sat as ad hoc judge and those who've made almost a career of being ad hoc judge. Ellie sat once as an ad hoc judge, though it was clear that it was a role he relished and which he fulfilled with immense care and total command of the pleadings. But this occurred at a time in the early 20s when the court was embarking through its practice direction 7 on putting temporal space between the role of counsel and the role of an ad hoc judge. Happily, sufficient time had run on since his role as ad hoc judge in the Bosnia and Herzegovina against Serbia and Montenegro case for him to be once again counsel in the certain documents case between Timor-Leste and Australia in 2013. Now, it's commonplace to say that an ad hoc judge is meant to be impartial and not an extra counsel for his or her appointing state in the court's deliberation chamber. And some ad hoc judges achieve this better than others. Some make more weighty points of law than do others. But in the entire history of the Permanent Court and the International Court, there's never been so deep an analysis, albeit so short, of the role of the ad hoc judge, so impressive that I believe it will continue to be referred to and cited through the ages. And what Ellie did was really exceptional, and unlike the usual task of the ad hoc judge, will not pass with the conclusion of the case. I refer, of course, to what he had to say on this subject in the so-called genocide case in his separate opinion. He there recalls that an ad hoc judge makes his solemn declaration under Article 20 of the statute that he'll exercise his powers impartially and conscientiously. But as Ellie immediately puts in counterpoint, the institution of ad hoc judge was created for the purpose of giving a party not otherwise being upon the bench a judge of its nationality, an opportunity to join in the work of the court. He said, I quote, this has led many to assume that an ad hoc judge must be regarded as a representative of the state that appoints him, and therefore as necessarily pre-committed to the position that that state may adopt. He then goes to the heart of the issue. And here is his short words. Nevertheless, consistently with the duty of impartiality by which the ad hoc judge is bound, there's still something specific that distinguishes his role. He has, I believe, the special obligation to endeavor to ensure that, so far as is measurable, every relevant argument in favor of the party that has appointed him has been fully appreciated in the course of collegial consideration and ultimately is reflected, though not necessarily adopted, in any separate or dissenting opinion he may write. Now, how carefully have these words been chosen? How admirable is the drafting? It cannot be better said, and they will remain in place for all that is to come. I want to say a word about the Institut. Ellie loved the Institut de droit international, and the Institut members loved him. His hospitality was boundless. The countless dinners he offered were enormously enjoyed, not only because of the good food and wine that Ellie insisted upon, but because of his joie de vivre. This outgoing enthusiasm matched, I think, in all aspects of his working life, we should also perceive as a contribution to international law. Ellie, like many others of his generation in the United Kingdom, was not much interested in the theory of international law. For him, it was practical matters that caught his attention, and thus it was at the Institut. In the Institut, world leaders in international law write long and scholarly reports on assigned topics, which are then subjected to the scrutiny of other members or associates. And when not themselves such a rapporteur, they're members of one or more commissions answering in writing questionnaires sent to them by the rapporteur. Ellie was elected to the Institut way back in 1979. There's no substantive report or resolution authored by him. And I can say from experience that if Ellie volunteered for membership of a commission, it was not to be expected that he would send in written answers to the rapporteur's questionnaire or regularly attend commission meetings. This collegial method of abstract drafting did not appeal to him, but individually he did all that he could to make the Institute more efficient. That was where his interest lay. All venerable institutions with a less than youthful membership are open to the claim that they need to improve their efficiency. This is not the place to rehearse substantive details as to what in the Institute's rules, procedures, and work methods have worked well and not so well. We're talking about Eli rather than the workings of the many, many bodies he was associated with. But to maximize the efficient working of the Institute was Eli's great interest and a matter on which he, above all, took a decisive lead. And in 1999, he had proposed in Berlin a resolution to establish a constitutional committee that would look at simply everything. Such a committee was established with Eli as its rapporteur. The proposals, which in fact did not require statutory change, inevitably met with some resistance, although one or two of them have been accepted and have worked rather well. And when Eli fell ill and was no longer able to work in this committee, he continued to make his voice heard on these matters and in the further discussions in 2009. Eli did feel somewhat disappointed at the outcome of his work on constitutional reform. He'd had in mind a broad range of proposals which would have enhanced the work of the Institute. The proposals that remained were limited in their reach and substance. It's a mark of the affection and appreciation for Eli that even after his death, the United Kingdom group application, which had previously been made for him to be afforded honorary membership, still went ahead. And the voting was a posthumous expression of admiration for their recently deceased colleague. And it was the more special as Kathy was there in Hyderabad to witness it. Eli was, above all, a practitioner. The articles he published were often about particular cases or were tributes to colleagues or were about nationalization for property. But I think it's not for those that he'll be remembered. Those of us who had the good fortune to be taught by Eli will never forget that he was a superb teacher. His friendly and accessible lecturing style was extremely attractive, making the subject, for me, international institutions in the LLM, exciting and interesting. He made his students really interested in the subject, longing to find out more and yet more. Thanks to Eli, international law was not a chore, but a delight. And as one of the obituaries in the UK papers put it, he had the whiff of cordite about him. In other words, the students knew that he was involved in this case or that, and that what he would tell them in his lectures would reflect this reality. And of course, they loved it. Eli's Life of Herschel Outerpacht is a superb work of scholarship. At the outset, Eli writes, "I've hesitated to call this work a biography, as in some sections, it's little more than a bare recitation of facts. I claim neither the skills nor the experience to write a text that by its presentation, ideas, imagination, and general style can be called literature or more precisely biography." But that is exactly what Eli did. And we may well imagine the daunting issues facing him when working his way through the letters in the cabin trunks and contemplating how to tell in detail the story of Hirsch's life and all the difficult decisions he would that would have to be made. Ellie solved all the problems in various ways, including by providing an informative, unobtrusive, and balanced commentary. His task in this work of filial devotion was much, much more than editorial. It was Ellie's editorial decisions and his own writing that have turned raw materials into a remarkable book. And if I may briefly quote from the conclusion of my review in the American Journal of International Law, I said there, "It's a vastly impressive homage to his father, but it also stands by the enormity of the job undertaken and by the skill with which it's been carried out as a monument to another great international lawyer, Ellie Lauterpacht." We know how much we owe Ellie, the great practitioner, and I found it interesting in these remarks to realize how very unusual was his career path. I so much wish I could today ask Ellie, "Was this a deliberate choice to do what you wanted to do, Ellie, or did it just happen?" We can only be grateful that this beloved giant of our profession followed his special roads.